Yes.
Good morning and afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Before we begin the session today, we're going to review a couple of features of the webinar platform. She's already done that. sorry about that. This is Marissa DeMaia. I'm going to be serving as moderator for today's session. Today's program is brought to you as a collaborative effort between the Great Lakes and Southwest ADA Centers, members of the ADA National Network. This session is offered as part of the ongoing ADA Legal Webinar Series. Again, today's session is being recorded, and the recording will be available for review within about 24 hours of the conclusion of this session. A copy of the PowerPoint presentation for today's session was available for download prior to the start of the session. So if you were not able to access them that ahead of time, you'll be able to access that in the materials in the archive section of the website. And that will be available at www.ada-audio.org/archives/ADA-legal. And that will be available within about 24 hours following the conclusion of the session. Our presenters today are going to provide us with some great information, and at the conclusion of the presentation, there will be an opportunity for everyone to ask questions. Please follow the instructions provided for submitting your questions to the presenters. You won't be able to see the questions as you're submitting them. They will be viewable to me as your moderator and our presenters. So again, we'll discuss them at the end of the session. Feel free to submit them as they come to your mind during the presentation. If you do have a question for one of our presenters in particular too, go ahead and include their name there. That helps us out a little bit. I'm going to begin today's session by introducing our two presenters, Danette Vaughn and Elaine Roberts. For those of you who may not be familiar, Danette is currently Senior Attorney with Disability Rights Texas, an organization federally mandated to advocate for and protect the rights of people with disabilities. And Elaine Roberts. Elaine is currently the Executive Director of the Dispute Resolution Center of Montgomery County, Inc., an organization that provides alternative dispute resolution services and training to residents of Montgomery County and surrounding counties in Texas. You can read a little bit more about our presenters by accessing their bios on the website, again at www.ada-audio.org/webinar/ADA-legal. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Danette. Danette?
I actually think Elaine's going to start.
Oh, sorry, Elaine.
Yes, thank you, Marissa. And hello, everyone. This is Elaine Roberts. We want to thank you for joining Danette and me to discuss the rights of persons with disabilities to be accompanied by service animals in public accommodations. And you may ask why we chose this topic, since there seems to be so much written on it and so much in the press about it. And the reason that we chose this topic is that even though the laws have been around for a while, starting with the guide dog rules, it still seems to be an area of confusion. And in fact, this week, the Department of Justice in one of its broadcasts said that it's one of the most highly contested areas. It's one of the areas where they get the most complaints. So it seems though, even though there's a lot out there about service animals, the information is not necessarily being understood. So we hope that by becoming familiar with some of the laws that apply in this area, it'll make you aware not only of your rights and responsibilities either as a person with disabilities, a business owner, a government agency, but that it'll give you an opportunity to see what has happened in Texas. And through a concerted effort of veterans, dog trainers, disability advocates, and legislative members we've been able to accomplish with Boots' Law. And hopefully, even if you're not living in Texas, you'll be able to learn from the good and the bad of the recent legislation that's taken place in Texas with regard to service animals, and to assist you in drafting legislation for your state. And as slide number 11 shows you, we hope that by the end of this presentation, you'll know a little bit more about exactly who is Boots and why does he have a law named after him. Now, you'll note that the picture of Boots, he has a really nice vest with an American flag on it. And one of the things that we'll talk about today is, even though he is pictured with this vest, you're going to hear repeatedly that service animals are not required to be vested. So that's one of the changes that have come about in recent legislation and in recent changes to regulations. But just wanted you to be aware of that as you see the picture of Boots in his beautiful vest. Now, there are many statutes that cover service animals or assistance animals, as they're labeled in some of the statutes. Among them are the Americans with Disabilities Act, which, of course, you probably know was passed in 1990 to protect more than 45 million individuals with disabilities from discrimination and to ensure full and equal access. In 2008, the Americans with Disabilities Act was amended in part to overturn some legal definitions that had made it difficult for individuals to show proof that they were a person with a disability. So when we talk about people with disabilities today, we're going to be using the expanded scope of the definition of persons with disabilities. So we'll be talking about persons with mental or physical disability, people who have a record of a disability, regarded as having a disability, and also those who are protected by being associated with someone with a disability. And a person with a disability is going to be someone with a mental or physical disability or impairment that substantially interferes with major life activities or major bodily functions. And this is of particular importance to our veterans who were so active in the legislation in Texas, because it would cover PTSD, physical impairments, visual impairments, or hearing impairments that may be of particular interest to them. And so with that in mind, you'll hear us talking about the ADA as one of our primary areas of focus. Law number 2 is Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which is applicable to recipients of federal financial assistance. It has its own provisions for service animals, as does the Fair Housing Act, the Air Carrier Access Act dealing with air travel, IDEA for schools, which deals with students from early childhood interventions through graduation up to the age of 22 in Texas, as well as the Texas Human Resources Code, which we're going to refer to today as Chapter 121, and the Texas Health and Safety Code. And of course, in any discussion of disabilities, it's going to be important to work with the law that is most protective, the one that gives you the most rights, and the one that is specific to the type of situation that you're in. So for purposes of our focus, on slide 13, you'll see that we're talking primarily today about the ADA Title II, which deals with public services, governmental entities. Primarily, ADA Title III, dealing with public accommodations and services. Chapter 121 of the Texas Human Resources Code, which is encompassed in Boots' bill, along with the Texas Health and Safety Code. And chapter 121 deals with governmental and private facilities within the state of Texas. And chapter 437 is dealing with restaurants. And so these are some of the areas that you see it common to have service animal cases coming up in areas of retail, governmental services, medical facilities, transportation. So with that in mind, I'm going to turn it over to Danette at this point.
Hi, this is Danette Vaughn. I want to pick up on the Title II and Title III focus that we are mainly looking at today here and with the state law that we'll discuss later. Originally, we were looking primarily at Title III, but I think many of you are in government offices sufficiently that you need to be aware how similar those two sections are. Under Title II, that applies to public entities. It's a government or a state, local government office. It can also apply, and this is in the slide, to something called a special purpose district or an instrumentality of the state. I've only rarely seen the instrumentality of the state. The only time I ran into that was a probation office that technically was not a state office but was an instrumentality. So you probably will not have to deal with that as much. The state areas can be different departments and agencies. It does not have to be the state of Texas per se. It could be the Department of Human Services. It could be the Department of Transportation. I have had a case that involved the state capitol at one point. And the local government offices, most frequently I run into that with City Hall and the courthouse, but it can be other things as well. On slide 15, we're talking here about what the statute says is prohibited, where it is prohibited. So it's in services, programs, and activities. And that can take on a variety of items. It's sometimes people assume the accessibility factor is just, can you get in the building? It's a broader process than that. Are they making modifications to allow you to access their programs and services or any activities that are related to that? Some of the things that I have run across that fit those things, even with service dogs, having a youth who wants to go to a summer school program or a summer parks and recreation program and wants to take the service dog with them, somebody who's going to a sporting event, a football game, basketball game, they want to take the service dog with them. Those can all be programs or activities of that entity. Under the ADA, both Title II and Title III, the agency, whether it's a public agency or private, is required to modify their policies if necessary to prevent discrimination. That includes, by the definition, both state and federally, that it includes service animals as a modification. So if someone has a policy that they do not allow pets on the premises, then they are informed that a service animal is not a pet. It's not considered to be a pet. It's considered to be an aid and advice for the person with a disability. So pets, the pet rule would have to be modified to a reasonable change in order to allow them to enter with a service dog. Going to slide 16, Title III. Title III is the definition for the private entity. Private entities are broader, and that's where I end up with most of my cases. That is anything that's not a public entity. So if it's not a local government office or a state office, then it's considered to be a public entity. That can take a wide variety. And private entities are normally considered or discussed as public accommodations. That's the phrase you're most likely to hear. It can include restaurants, clubs, stores. There is an exception for religious organizations and some private clubs under the ADA that you have to look at if that involves your situation. Not all churches, not all portions of churches are exempt because they could have areas where the service dog would be allowed. But generally on a public accommodation, it's the same as with a government office. They should make a modification to their policies if they have a no pet policy and you want to bring a service animal in. This private entity can also, under the terms of the statute, can also include the people who own the building, the people who lease the building, or the people who are the landlords for the building. I have used that on occasion with things that may not be obvious. some people think that that's only going to apply if they're talking about the physical structure of the building, but I have used it before when somebody was leasing space from a hotel and would not provide the accommodation, and so we worked with the hotel to get the accommodation. Slide 17, I switch to, here's the examples. The private entities include lodging establishments, can be any kind of hotel, motel, potentially a bed and breakfast, depending on how it's set up. Food establishments may not be just restaurants. You could have a deli attached to a grocery store. You could have somebody furnishing food at a function, and they're trying to keep the dog away from the food. Although it's oftentimes the restaurants, it may not be totally the restaurants. Theaters and stadiums are included, stores and businesses of all kinds of stores and businesses. Hospitals and pharmacies are included as well. That sometimes creates a problem for some people because they think there's too much of a risk of affecting the sanitation of the facility. But they should allow them in under certain conditions, certain places. The other area that I've added on here that people sometimes do not know about are lawyers and doctor's offices. And surprisingly, I find a lot of lawyers that don't know about that as well, that they have to allow these modifications, including service dogs in their facilities. Doctor's offices, because they often think of themselves as being medical and sterile areas, they will exclude people with service dogs. They do have to make the same modifications for areas where the person is going and taking the dog. The types of animals has changed. It used to be, well, it kind of got out of hand, frankly, because I even had, sometime I was reading on one where somebody had a snake, a service snake. So they tightened down a little bit on the definition a few years ago, and now under the ADA, only dogs are considered to be service animals. There is nothing that limits what kind of dog, but it has to be a canine, it has to be a dog. For this definition under this statute, no other animal is considered. The only other exception, which we'll be discussing later, is there is an exception written in the statute for miniature horses. And they're not considered service animals. They still are under the definition. But under some circumstances, someone may need to or be required to make a modification to their policies in order for miniature horses. People have miniature horses for different reasons. One of them is that they live a lot longer than dogs once they train them. And there's other reasons that we'll discuss with you for that later. But generally, it's only a dog. So if somebody's trying to take in their monkey or their cat or anything else, they're going to be excluded as a service animal.
Okay, now with regard to slide number 19, you could see that the definition of service animal that became effective in March of 2011 has changed. It's clearly defining it as the service animal means any dog that is individually trained to do work and perform tasks for the benefit of an individual with a disability, including individuals with physical, sensory, psychiatric, intellectual, or other mental disabilities. And when we talk about being able to do work or perform tasks, the person with a disability that is claiming an animal as a service animal needs to be able to describe what particular task the dog is trained to perform. And there are many uses of dogs that people generally wouldn't think of. That we'll talk about in just a few minutes, but you need to be able to articulate that. So what type of work or task might a dog be asked to do? First of all, the task that the dog is individually trained to do must be directly related to the handler's disability. And this is where we talk about the person being able to describe what is it that the dog does for you in order to be of service to you related to a disability. It does not require formal training. It does not require any type of vest or marking. And we're going to save you $250 right now on those internet kits that are being advertised to make your dog a service animal within 20 minutes. Those are not required. They're not legitimate, so you can go ahead and save your money on those. As we talked about with Boots, as a privacy matter, animals no longer, service dogs no longer have to wear a vest. They don't have to have a sign. They don't have to have anything that denotes that they are a service animal. Although an individual may choose to have those things, and that's their right to choose to have it, they aren't required to have it. Also, it's important to note that a service animal requirement is not breed specific. And this typically will come up in two different types of scenarios. First of all, the blanket exclusion type scenario where you have quote unquote your bad or scary dogs. Those are things like chows, pit bulls, Rottweilers, things that people assume are going to be dangerous. Well, the ADA makes it clear that these blanket exclusions are no longer applicable. And there is one case that has already addressed this area. The Sachs versus Aurelia case dealt with a veteran who was also a retired policeman who used a pit bull named Snickers as an assistance animal. And Aurelia had a total ban on pit bulls. As a result of the litigation, there was a compromise. First, Mr. Sachs and his wife were allowed to keep Snickers as a service animal. And then if anything happened to Mr. Sachs, his wife was also allowed to keep him as a pet after his death. The family agreed to install an 8-foot fence around the property, and the city agreed to pay for the Sachs legal fees. So I'm not sure that the family would have necessarily been required to install the 8-foot fence. It was something that they agreed to. But I think the Sachs case kind of helps to clarify why the blanket exclusion of the bad or scary dog is no longer going to be acceptable. But even though you can have a service animal that is one of these breeds, such as a chow, a pit bull, or a Rottweiler, or maybe even a German Shepherd might fall into what people consider to be a scary dog, the animal must still be well behaved and must be under the animal's control in order for it to be allowed into a place of public accommodation or a public facility. So that's the first type of general type of argument that we typically might see in terms of animals. The other type is the small dog argument, where you see somebody like Boots, small rat terrier. People make assumptions or they stereotype, and they may say because of Boots' small size, he's not as strong, he can't possibly be doing any type of service for his owner. But the ADA makes it clear that it's an individualized task. So a small animal like Boots may be cleared to assist the person as reminding them to take their medication, checking out areas of stores if a person has a fear of going into open spaces as a result of PTSD. So both the scary dog and the small dog are now included in the protected class. So what are some of the tasks that you might see service animals performing? If you turn to slide number 21, some of the examples given in the regulations, although it's not an exhaustive list, are guiding an individual who is blind or have low vision. This is probably the most the area where people are most familiar with seeing service animals. They might be pulling someone's wheelchair. They might be retrieving items for the individual. They might be assisting a person with a mobility impairment with balance and stability. They might provide alerts and assistance to someone who is about to experience seizures. They may assist an individual with a psychiatric disability or PTSD to remain calm. But we want to caution you on this. That's different from being an emotional support animal, which is no longer considered to be a service animal. You still have to have a specific task that that dog is trained to do in order to calm the person. And so you have to be able to articulate what the individualized task that dog is doing in order to assist the person to remain calm. It may carry medication or alert when the individual is supposed to be taking the medication. One of the things that we learned in taping the Boots video from the trainer is that some of the dogs are trained to alert when it's time to take the medication and they get a treat at that point, but then they also obtain a second treat when they have alerted and the person's actually taken. So they'll take in the medication. So they will be trained to not only alert, but to continue to remain vigilant until the person actually takes their medication. It might be alerting someone with diabetes to glucose levels, whether it's a rise of glucose level or a lowering of glucose levels. Or it may be alerting someone who is deaf or hard of hearing to alarms or evacuation sounds. So as you can see, there are many tasks here that were particularly relevant to veterans returning from service with traumatic brain injuries, with mobility issues, with perhaps deafness or hard of hearing, mobility concerns, psychiatric concerns.
Going to Danette. What you're actually asking them to do, the entity to do, if you're bringing your service animal in and they have a no pet policy or a no animal policy, is you're asking them to make a reasonable accommodation. And reasonable is still an operative word. You can't ask for the moon and always get it. It has to be something that's based on the need for the service animal to be there or the person validly has a service animal. Reasonable can sometimes take in different focuses depending on where you're at. And we'll talk a little bit later about restaurants, but oftentimes restaurants or food establishments or even places where they serve drinks may be concerned about the reasonableness of the medication, as are hospitals, because they focus on a health safety issue, although there have been several cases that have discussed the limitations even at hospitals or restaurants. Again, we go back to their modifying their policies, practices, and procedures. So if someone is entering with a service dog and they say, look, we have a policy against no animals in here, that's their policy. And the person with the service dog is then asking them for a reasonable modification to that policy to allow them to bring them in consistent with both federal and in Texas state law. They do have some potential defenses as the entity, the restaurant, the club, has a defense. And one of those things is to show that it would fundamentally alter the nature of their program or activity. That is something that the restaurants have tried to claim before, and it's not held up over the long term. But if they can show that, and the burden is on them to show that there's a fundamental alteration, then there could be a decision by the court that this is a particular situation where a service animal should not be in, or should not be allowed to be brought in. Since we do have some veterans on here, I did want to point out specifically some things that the veterans might run into that are not necessarily covered by the ADA, so I want to briefly mention that to you. Many of the veterans are in and out of federal agencies once they get back, or even active duty members. That federal agency may not be covered by ADA, but it may be covered by Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. So even if they tell you they're not covered by the ADA, you may have another way to get that modification done. There's two other areas that I think have been of interest to the veterans specifically that I have represented. One of them is military installations. This is a different, that's a whole different animal on a military installation. But what you may find if you are an active duty veteran or an active duty soldier or veteran going in, the particular base may have a policy or procedure about that. The one I can refer you to if you need a reference is Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio has one. It's in a policy memo 12-005. And that opened up bringing service animals on the base and gave some definition to that. The other problem where veterans had problems getting these modifications and finding whether people arguing they weren't reasonable or they fundamentally altered was VA facilities. The VA hospitals, the VA clinics were not allowing anyone to come in with a service animal. That was changed by a statute, which was actually good for 2 years, and I have not checked to see if it's been renewed. But in 2012, there was a statute that was entered that was, the short form name of it is Honoring Americans Veterans and Caring for Camp Lejeune and Families Act, and it was of 2012. And it was good from 2012 through January 2014, subject to being renewed. It actually overturned what was previously a limitation at VA facilities that banned even service animals. Now service animals are allowed on the veterans' property, on the VA property, in the medical facilities when either the active duty personnel or the veteran needs to come in for that. Okay. There are the next stage, if you're going in with your service animal and you're trying to figure out what's going to happen, this can sometimes run into problems. And I get this both ways because the business or the government office is allowed to ask you, if you have a service animal, two questions. Sometimes what I find is people get upset, and this is in some of the cases as well, where they've lost their cases because a business was asking the proper inquiry, but the person with the service animal started saying, you're violating my rights, I don't have to answer any questions to you, I already told you it was my service dog, that's all I have to tell you. And that's not exactly correct. It's somewhat in the ballpark, but it's not correct. And if the person with the service dog refuses to answer the allowable questions, then the court may find that it was a reasonable exclusion. The store reasonably excluded them. The two things that they can ask you is that a service animal that's required because of a disability? And once they get that answer, the next question that they can ask you is, what work or task does the animal do? What has it been trained to do for you? That does not mean that they're asking broader questions. So those two things need to be, if you're using a service animal, you need to be very well aware of that so that you answer those questions. What they're not allowed to ask about is the nature or the extent of your disability. They can't ask you, well, what's wrong with you? Why do you have a dog? What disability? You don't look like you're blind, which is a common thing that I hear. They can only ask you the prior two questions. They also can't say, okay, well, you say it's a service dog, but you need to show me the proof that it is. Give me your certification. Give me your documents. Show me who trained it, that it was a certified trainer. There are still people asking both of those questions that will just rudely ask about the disability and want to inquire what it is or tell you how you should handle it differently. And a lot of people will still ask for documentation. There actually isn't documentation available. Sometimes the training agencies, if you have a trainer, a professional trainer, they may give some sort of card, maybe an ID card or a badge that you can clip on with a lanyard or something like that. But it's not legally required, and we have discouraged the state from even issuing a card that shows that because we're afraid people will start requiring it when it's not required. Okay, documentation issue, there has been a push by some of them, if you're veterans, there has been a push by one specific training organization to try to get the military bases to change that. And that may be something that you're going to have to deal with if you're on a military base or a military facility at some point, that they are looking at a particular professional trainer. The statute does not require a professional trainer. You can train your own dog if you want to. Someone else can train your dog as long as they're training for tasks and those tasks are related to your disability. Other things they shouldn't ask, really, if it's a readily apparent, a visible disability, they shouldn't be asking you at all. So if someone's clearly in a wheelchair, for example, and the dog is pulling a wheelchair, or someone is blind, and clearly that's what the dog is doing, they shouldn't even come up and start inquiring about whether it's a service dog and what is the task that the dog does for you. It can also be sometimes a little different if it's a disability that's on balance or stability of the person, but oftentimes those dogs are wearing a harness that's a hard harness, not just a leash, and it's also clearly visible that they're helping with balance. And it just may be a little less clear to the person who works in the store that it's a readily recognizable disability, because the balance issues may only come up if someone has a seizure or some other episode. And so you may still get some questions with that. But generally, if it's readily recognizable, they shouldn't be asking you questions at all. Here's your obligations if you're the handler of the dog. Some of the statutes will say the individual with the dog. Some will say the handler with the dog. But if you are the person with a disability who is taking a service animal in to some place, you have responsibilities as well. And if you fail to maintain those responsibilities, they can lawfully exclude you from the premises with the dog. They would still be obligated to give you a chance to participate in the activities and the programs without the dog, but they can exclude the dog. The dog is required, you as the handler are required to have the dog under control, and it should be either connected to you with a leash, a tether, a harness. Not everybody can hold the leash, so it may be connected to, tied to a belt, or it could be tied to the wheelchair, but it needs to be connected to the handler in some way for the most part. The exceptions to that would be that sometimes particular services the dog is performing, if the dog is on a leash or a harness, they cannot work for the task they're supposed to do. Even if that occurs, though, for instance, somebody could not hold the leash and be in their wheelchair at the same time, so they need the dog to walk next to them. Even with that, the dog has to be under control. Voice commands, hand signals, other means, but the dog has to do what you tell the dog to do when you tell the dog to do it. The dog can't be running all over the store and misbehaving. The dog has to be housebroken. Obviously, if that occurs, they can exclude you. If the dog is growling at people, getting protective, but in growling and being aggressive in some way, they can ask you to leave. Or if the dog is just running and jumping on things and not in the control of the handler, then they can ask the handler to remove the dog. And that's not going to be actionable against them when they ask, because it means the handler hasn't fulfilled their obligation.
Okay, now I'm on slide 28, and I'm going to talk to you, 27, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the miniature horse exception that we talked about just briefly a few slides ago. And as we noted earlier, that a miniature horse is not a service animal under the definition. But if you're a person who, say, is allergic to a dog, can't have a dog, a miniature horse may be an alternative for you. Some people, for religious purposes, are not allowed to have service animals as dogs, but they are allowed to have miniature horses. This would be an area, then, that you would want to concentrate on. In doing this research and in talking to people about it, I thought it was interesting that the Guidehorse Foundation gives some of the reasons why a person might want to consider a guide horse or a miniature horse exception under the ADA. First of all, the Guidehorse Foundation talks about the calm nature of the horses. They have a great memory. Their focus is extremely long. They're naturally safety conscious. If it's a choice between a safer and a less safe route, they will typically alert whoever they're working with to the safer route. And they've got good stamina and strength. Of course, the National Restaurant Association, which is one of the chief opponents to the use of miniature horses, doesn't necessarily agree with these things, but it is a choice for some people, particularly if you want longevity. As some of the articles have pointed out, horses can live for up to 25 years. So once you have a trained miniature horse, you don't have to keep replacing or retraining. And so that might be an issue that you would consider in deciding to choose a miniature horse. And under the ADA, reasonable modifications must be made to allow the use of a miniature horse that has been individually trained to do work or perform tasks for the benefit of the individual with the disability. Again, as long as it doesn't fundamentally alter the service or program. And this actually is a really hot area of litigation right now. Some of the cases that are coming up that you might want to follow if you're a miniature horse enthusiast, a California man is currently suing Marshalls and GameStop because they excluded him from using his miniature horse that he utilizes to pull his wheelchair. He was not allowed to go into the store, and he's currently suing them for denial of admittance and seeking $4,000 in damages. In Blue Ash, Ohio, there's a young child who basically utilized a miniature horse for support and balance. And according to the family, this enabled her to be able to come out into the public, be able to do things that she had not been able to do before. And she's currently suing the town for forcing her to get rid of the horse. And she indicates that it's causing her to lead a more sedentary and secluded life. Of course, you know, these are new cases that are coming up through the litigation path. We don't know what the rulings are going to be. I've personally spoken with some of the law enforcement officers at the airport in Houston who say that there is a miniature horse who is a guide horse that comes basically every week through the Houston airports. And they said he is one of the finest trained, most docile animals that they've ever seen, and that they have no problems at all with him. They're glad to see him come each week. So if you are going to take a miniature horse into a place of public accommodation or a governmental entity, what are the factors that are going to be considered in order to determine if it's a reasonable request that you're making? If you look at slide 28, we've outlined some of these things that they're going to look at. They're going to look at the type, the size, and the weight of the animal, and can the facility accommodate that animal. Miniature horses are typically only 24 to 34 inches high, and they typically only weigh 70 to 100 pounds. And I'm going to contrast that with a case that came up in Dallas where an individual was trying to have claimed that a full-size horse should be allowed onto a second floor apartment. Well, that was not a case under the ADA, it was under the Fair Housing Act, but still you can see the difference. The difference being a much smaller horse, not as heavy, confined spaces, that's going to be one of the factors that would be considered. They're going to consider whether the handler has sufficient control. Now, in the case that we talked about just a few minutes ago, and that's occurring in Blue Ash, Ohio, they said that the miniature horse was well behaved and it was trained to respond to the child's hand gestures as well as her verbal commands. So the same thing that's expected of a service dog is going to be expected of a miniature horse that's being used, not technically termed as a service animal, but that is being allowed to assist a person with a disability in a place of public accommodation or governmental building. They're going to also look at whether the horse, miniature horse, is housebroken. So this is becoming one of the key areas of dispute in these types of cases. You have proponents that say, yes, horses can be taught to do anything that dogs can do, and you have other opponents of miniature horses who say it's just not physically possible to do. Not being a horse expert, I can't tell you whether it's physically possible to housebreak, but that is one of the key concerns of the restaurant about the hygienic nature of having horses. And as the litigation goes forward, I'm sure we'll be getting more guidance on that area of whether courts are actually finding it to be something that a horse is capable of doing. And then the final factor that is going to be reviewed is, does the horse's presence compromise a legitimate safety requirement? And in terms of this, as well as with dogs, one of the things that is not going to be considered is other patrons' allergies or their aversions to animals. So if another patron says, I'm allergic to animals, or I'm afraid of animals, a horse or a dog, that's not going to be enough to deny access. It's going to have to be some other type of safety concern that is raised that's legitimate. But again, as Danette noted to you earlier, even if it is determined that it's not reasonable for you to bring a horse into a specific location because of one of these four factors, they are still going to have to offer you access to the goods and services in some way, shape, or form. So that doesn't end the public facility or governmental entity's responsibility. Danette's going to be talking to you.
We're going to shift now to more about the state law. And I want to start by kind of explaining how this came about. That was some of the questions that we get frequently, is how did this happen, that we got changes to this. Actually, House Bill 489 is not a new bill. It was, Chapter 121 was there already. The Health and Safety Code already had provisions. But what we were seeking was originally to get them modified so that they were more in line with the ADA provisions. The old statute under 121 had some specific training language that more closely resembled the way that guide dogs were trained, where they train them for several months and then they bring the person with a disability there and they work with them for a month or so before they go back. That wasn't consistent with the ADA, but that was in the state law. So we were hoping to get some of that changed. But I wanted to explain here a little bit the role that veterans and people in the military played in helping us to get this changed. We obviously have a lot of bases and a lot of VA hospitals and VA clinics in Texas. And a lot of people who are coming back are staying closer to those, so we're getting more people in those areas who are returning veterans using service dogs as well. I wanted to explain sort of how this happened. Boots, that you're seeing in the picture, that you see signing the bill, and that's attached, you see the Governor Perry put his paw print on the bill because the short name for the bill became Boots's bill. And that was because of a lawsuit that was filed. The young man that's in the picture with him is his handler. He was a returning veteran who was active in Operation Red Dawn in the section that caught Saddam Hussein. Came back, he'd been diagnosed with various disabilities and had a service animal. He went into a store where he was not only excluded, but when he went to the parking lot to call the police to do a report, store employees came out and started mocking him and making fun of him. He had on Wounded Warrior clothes. and one of them told him to go take off his Wounded Warrior shirt and go occupy Wall Street. So that when that case was filed, that information came out. Soon after that, we were contacted by Representative Menendez, Jose Menendez's office, who actually had a chief of staff member who was a disabled veteran himself. And they were not happy about it. And the question was, what can we do to help? Initially, what we did was connect them with the veterans and say, just talk to them, because they're in any given area, especially around VA hospitals and still military bases, there are some groups developing of veterans who are having kind of support groups, and they do things together, and they take their animals when they go. So he first met with them to discuss what problems they were having, and it was a question that I frankly couldn't answer because I don't know all the questions, the problems they ran into at different places. And then after that, decided to propose some language. But Menendez was the chair of the Veterans Committee, the Veterans Issues Affairs Committee. And so instead of running it through just a general issue on disability law, this particular bill was taken through the veterans law, and veterans came forward to support it. Specialist Gallegos came and testified. There was a woman named Colonel Carol Anderson, who was just in the process of retiring from the military, who came with her pit bull. So they were there testifying. They had their service animals. There were people there monitoring or watching what was going on. Other veterans came to the testimony at the Veterans Committee and brought their service dogs. So if you go back and look at that film, you'll periodically just see a service dog walking in as they check the seat. There was probably at least five or six service dogs in the committee hearing when they had it. What was originally started was to raise the amounts for the punishments, both the criminal punishment and the civil punishment that we'll talk about. And after the political process, which some of you may be more familiar with than I am, it obviously got bannered around and things got changed a little bit during that political process. But on the very last day that this could be passed, it was passed, and it included the overall issues that were relating to Texas and modifying that. So what we ended up with, if you look at slide 30, there was modifications to Chapter 121, and that was signed off on in June of 2013. There was also modifications to the Health and Safety Code. That really came about, I believe, because of the involvement with the Restaurant Association, because their reaction when we were talking about raising the penalties for things were, you know, the restaurant owners are kind of freaking out about this because they don't want some 16-year-old who's working for them at McDonald's or Dairy Queen to be making a mistake and suddenly they've got this huge penalty. So they changed that a little bit, but they also specifically put it in the Health and Safety Code because the Restaurant Association people were not normally reading the Texas Human Resources Code. But they were very familiar with the Texas Health and Safety Code. So when they would say, well, the health inspector won't allow a dog in here, then somebody can cite the Health and Safety Code, and we produce materials that give them that. So that's also been in effect since 2013. The bill was signed in June of 2013, but it went into effect this past January, January 1. I put some links in there to the stories of the signing and one of the early stories about the case right when it was filed. I don't know if the video would still come up. A week ago, the videos were coming up, but when I tried them again this week, I just got the written story. So I don't know if you'll be able to see the video when you log on to those or not. The definition was similar to and made closer to what the ADA was. I'm looking at slide 31. Previously, it was assistance animal under state and service animal under ADA. So now it includes both. They have both languages or both wordings in there, that an assistance animal or a service animal is a canine. It has to be a dog, just like the ADA now, and specially trained or equipped to help a person with a disability. Again, because we're matching up to the ADA, what you don't see are requirements for professional trainers or specific kinds of training, or specific time frame that a dog has to be trained. The one thing that they do clarify, which is similar to what is the same as the ADA, is that it is no longer including an emotional support animal. When the ADA definition was changed, they removed that, And when the Texas statute was done, that was removed. That can be sometimes an interesting question for me. And if you're working with certain trainers, you may get a different response, because with these changes, we were focusing on the fact that it also included PTSD and mental health issues, but PTSD specifically was mentioned because of the number of veterans in the San Antonio area that had PTSD that were using service dogs. So that was included in the statute. I have run across some trainers that now say, or some dog handlers that say, well, the dog calms me, and calming is a task. I have issues with filing a case like that. There's not a case law on it yet. Nobody's tested it that I'm aware of. But an emotional support animal might be in your home with you to make you feel less alone and make you feel better. But they do that just by being present, just by being there with you. I don't personally consider that to be a task that makes that animal a psychiatric service dog. There are a whole slew of tasks that a psychiatric service dog does, and that's the things that I look for when I'm deciding which case I might want to file a complaint on or file a lawsuit on. And I'll give you a variety of those things, but even if the dog is calming, the dogs that I have mainly worked with, they have some sort of alert system. So the dog either nudges them on their leg. If they don't recognize them, they may get up in their lap or do something else to get their attention. If the dog is trying to remove the person from the scene, they may just do various things to get the handler's attention so that the handler has to take them outside from the stressful situation and then also remove themselves from the stressful situation. But I've also had, you know, service dogs who were helping with PTSD because of night terrors, nightmares that the veteran was having. The dogs have been trained, several of the dogs have been trained for different things. One dog I worked with was trained to turn on a light if he recognized that the veteran was having a nightmare, because that particular person also would walk in his sleep. He wouldn't wake completely up. So they trained the dog to first turn on the light in the room, and then the dog, who was a large dog, which was a very large dog, would lay on the military person so that he could not get out of bed until he was fully awake. That's how they kept him from sleepwalking. I've had several who, with the PTSD, do various things, and it may include standing between them. If somebody gets in between them, the dog will make sure if they're coming too close, not in an aggressive way, not in an attack dog sort of way, but just as a buffer way. One of the trainers explained to me that some of the soldiers with the PTSD, that one of the hardest things for them to do was to go to shopping malls where it was crowded, to go to grocery stores or any kind of store where you had an aisle in and out, and you got, you know, one way in, one way out. And what those dogs are trained to do, although they are psychiatric support dogs, one of their tasks is to go ahead, to do a search of the area. If they get to the end of the aisle, they may look left and right, make sure nobody's there that's going to surprise the dog handler. And then they come back and stand by them. So it allows that person, if they're in a mall, if they're in a crowded movie theater or whatever, they don't have to watch everybody that's, you know, within 100 feet of them or 200 feet of them. They have to watch the dog, and the dog will let them know if there's going to be a problem. So those are the kinds of tasks that I look for that separate out an emotional support animal. That doesn't mean that calming is not a factor of that, but I personally look for an alert of some sort, that when the dog recognizes the stress, that he alerts. And I've seen the animals that I've worked with do it, so I see the training. And it's been a variety of going up and just sitting first and staring at the person, and then maybe touching them on the leg, or if they were small enough, getting up in their lap to get their attention. So that does calm them, but there's something more than just being present to calm them. On page 32, slide 32, this is a little bit different statute. It's similar, and it's going to be similar to the way the ADA is designed, or described as who's a person with a disability. The Texas statute just writes it a little differently, so I wanted you to see how that is. Also says mental or physical, intellectual or developmental, a hearing impairment, deafness, speech impairment, visual impairment. But I highlighted on there the post-traumatic stress disorder. That was not there before, And that was something specifically that the Veterans Committee wanted to make sure was there, because it's such a higher increase in incidences with that. On page 33, slide 33, because this applies to public facilities, they list certain things as a public facility, things you might not normally think of. A highway, a sidewalk, a walkway may not be what you're normally thinking of. You may be thinking of a building, but that could occur in a public area as well. Common carriers and public transportation, obviously that could be buses, that could be cabs. One of the things we were talking about yesterday is that there's sometimes a problem with cabs. The perception is the cabs, if they see the service dog, they drive past you, and they will not stop and pick up somebody with a service dog because they don't want the dog in the cab. I've not had a case like that. I think it would be difficult to show that unless you could show a pattern somehow. But people know that's happening. They know that they're being excluded because of that. The other public transportation can either be mainline transit, where they might try to keep you from bringing your dog on, or try to put your dog in a cage or a crate of some sort, or paratransits. Some of the paratransits that are picking people up to take them to the hospitals have tried telling people they can't bring the dogs in, or they've got a special crate in the back and they've got to ride in that until they get to where they're going. And that's not really held up as well. So they have to be given equal access to these facilities without making it a big enough deal that somebody's embarrassed by what they're doing. The others are somewhat similar when you're talking about hotels, places of lodging. Buildings maintained by the government are specifically mentioned in the state law. So it's a combination of Title II and Title III together when you look at these definitions. Retail businesses, educational facilities, I get that all the time. Some parents with service got child school.
Seem to have lost our audio here from our presenters. Marissa, are you hearing anything?
I'm going to go ahead and move on to...
Did you skip it? Okay. The other things they cannot do, if you're going to slide 34, is they can't be required to pay an additional fee. This is same with ADA. They can't be required or refused admission because of the service animal. They can't be denied housing. Generally, that's going to be covered under the Fair Housing Act, but there is a specific provision in the state, Chapter 121, for that. The one that probably most often comes up on this is when you go to a hotel room and they want to charge you a pet deposit and a pet fee for cleaning, or you try to get in somewhere else and they're going to charge you an additional fee for the animal. The animal is not to be treated as a pet, even if they let it in, and there shouldn't be fees. You can be required to pay for damages that the animal does other than normal wear and tear. So if you leave an apartment or a place the same, then you it's not caused specifically by your dog, you know, tearing up the carpet or something, then that's a different issue with whether you should pay.
Okay, with regard to the protections that we've been talking about on Chapter 121, when you look at slide 35, a service animal in training is also going to be subject to the protection as long as they're accompanied by an approved trainer. Now, approved trainer is not defined in Chapter 121. It's sort of a holdover from when they had the original guide dog certifications and this type of thing. Since there are no certifications, we're just sort of advising people that that would include any, even include an owner, someone who is training their own dog. Now, another provision that's a little bit unique to Chapter 121 is a protection that no person may assault, harass, interfere with, or kill or injure in any way, or attempt to assault, harass, interfere with, kill, or injure an assistance animal. And this corresponds with Texas Penal Code 42.091, which uses the same definition as Chapter 121, but refers to the animals as assistance animals. And it has a range of penalties from a Class A misdemeanor when an animal is attacked, a service animal is attacked either by another dog or by a person, a state jail felony if they're injured, or a third degree felony if they're killed. and it requires mandatory restitution to the dog owner if the person is convicted, and it includes restitution for things like the vet bills, replacement costs if you have to get a new dog because of the attack, if you have to retrain an injured dog, or any reasonable expenses related to the attack. So Texas has some additional varieties of protections for its animals. On page 36 or slide 36, again, this is going to be very similar to the ADA. Well, actually, it's identical because they're only allowed to ask an individual who is bringing a service animal into a public facility. If the person's disability is not readily apparent, they can ask the two main questions: whether the service animal is required because of the person's disability, and what type of work or service the animal performs. On slide 37, criminal penalties are associated with Chapter 121. If an individual or an entity wrongfully excludes a service animal, Chapter 121.003 makes it a misdemeanor punishable by a fine of not more than $300. And upon conviction, the person can be assigned to do 30 hours of community service to either a governmental entity or a nonprofit agency which serves persons with disabilities. So we call this the empathy provision. Now, one of the things that really worried business owners was, okay, if all of these ads are coming up on the internet and everything, how do we know that this is really a service dog? And we'll get to the penalties for that in a minute. But on page 38, some of the other things that are unique about Chapter 21 is that if the person is successful in filing a claim under Chapter 121 or Boots's Law, they're deemed to have been deprived of their civil liberty. So there is an automatic presumption of damages of at least $300. And this varies from some of the other state laws. I was recently asked to look at the Louisiana law that was getting ready to be modified. And in the version that I saw, they were considering something that was very different from a presumption of damages, and they were actually going to require the person to prove up damages, which could be very difficult in a case like this. But I don't know how the Louisiana law finally wound up as it wound through the legislature, but that may be something that you want to look at your own state laws to see if they're requiring proof of damages or they're recognizing the loss of a civil liberty. If the person feels like they their rights have been violated and they've been wrongfully excluded because of a service animal, they are allowed to file a lawsuit. And although there is no recovery of attorney's fees, there is at least a presumption of damages in those particular types of lawsuits. Now, on slide number 39, we're getting to the provision that was put in to allay the fears of business owners who were wondering, how can I tell if this is really a service animal? What if somebody's going on the internet paying $250 getting their pet a certification? How do I know someone's not sneaking in something that will actually is a dog that is not trained that could be harmful? So there is a penalty provision under 121.006A for false representation. If the owner of a dog or a handler of a dog brings it in to a facility as a service animal when in fact it's not, they in turn can be prosecuted for a misdemeanor. So again, don't waste your dollars on those internet certifications. And the punishment for false representation with regard to a service animal is a fine of not more than $300, so it's a Class C misdemeanor in Texas. And the person who falsely represents a service animal, a pet as a service animal, can also be required to do 30 hours of community service in a nonprofit or a governmental entity that provides services or works with people with disabilities. I wasn't really able to find any cases where they had prosecuted someone on this, but there was one case that dealt with someone trying to sneak a five-month-old puppy in. And the court said that based on just the actions of the puppy and their inability to follow directions, it was clear that the puppy had not been, was not a service animal and had not been trained to be a service animal. So those are some of the provisions of Chapter 121 that we wanted you to be aware of.
The balance of the Boots Bill process was something we've talked about a little bit already, the food establishments. So I won't go too much into this, but you can see on slide 40, well, 40 talks about what it is. And the food establishment can also be a retail store or an other entity that serves food or sells food in some way. Can't deny the animal admittance, but it's specific into an area of the establishment of the store that is occupied by the entity and is open to the public. So that doesn't mean necessarily the kitchen, those sorts of areas where they might be preparing the food, but the restaurant area. And it shouldn't be isolated. I have had some people will say, well, you know, you can come in, we'll serve you, but you need to take your dog out to our patio area. You're not going to come inside. The person gets to choose where if they want to be on the inside of Roses instead of the patio of Roses, then they get to do that. But the area should not be used to prepare food. The factors that would make sense of it, they can take an animal in training into the establishments as long as it's actually validly in training. The service animal under the food establishment sections, again, two inquiries. This was an attempt to match up to the ADA so that we're getting different standards depending on which jurisdiction you were in or where you filed. Same questions would be asking whether they require the dog for a disability and what task the dog is trained to perform. The service animal is limited to a canine, just like with the ADA now. The language that's used in the statute is trained or equipped, specially trained or equipped, to help a person. We generally still look at the individually trained, specially trained to help a person, because that's the most common phrase that's used now. And it again, this does not include an animal that's just a comfort animal or emotional support, like a pet would be, even if they really need that additional support. If the dog's not doing a task, it's not going to meet this classification. The tasks that they can do, similar to what we've already seen, I don't think we really need to go over that completely except for the last one, because the last one was one that was added, calming a person who has post-traumatic stress disorder, was specifically added with the 2013 changes. That is the area that I don't think has been litigated yet and is causing some discussion because some people have acted as if or treated this as if the calming a person removes the task portion. I'm not willing to go to that point because it's not substantiated by the case law and because there is a separate area called emotional support animal for something that just calms. So I still think with this area, even with this language, you're going to need to have the task available or be able to show the task. I'm going to slide 44.
Okay. So what happens if you feel like your rights have been violated? You're going to have several options. First of those is a lawsuit. And we talked about that under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Titles II and Title III, well, primarily in Title III, you're going to be able to, well, both you'll be able to seek injunctive relief and attorney's fees for the prevailing party. But under Title III of the ADA, there are going to be no damages available in a private suit. Chapter 121 of the Texas Human Resources Code, you're going to be able to seek injunctive relief and damages, although you're not going to be able to receive attorney's fees under that particular statute. Third option might be an administrative complaint with the Department of Justice. And if you're able to show that there it's an ongoing and systemic issue of general importance, you might be able to get them to do an enforcement action. And if that is the case, as of April 24th of this year, the DOJ is able to seek no greater than $75,000 for the first violation of the ADA occurring after April 24th, and for any violation after that occurring after April 24th, they can apply for $150,000 in fines as well as seek damages. But given the large number of complaints that the DOJ receives every year, based on my experience, and I think Danette would say the same thing, it may be hard to get the DOJ's attention even with a good issue. So one of the alternatives that we'd like you to consider is mediation of ADA disputes. Based on our experience, we've seen it meet many of the needs, and there is even an aspect of the ADA that encourages mediation. So why should you even consider mediation? What is it? It's an informal process. There's no rules of evidence, no procedure. I'm on slide 45, and it's a trained, impartial person who is a mediator, helps disputing parties to communicate and find mutually satisfactory solutions. Basically, as long as you don't violate any laws, the parties can agree to anything. But one of the things that Keybridge did ask me to point out to you is if you are submitting mediation papers or a mediation request through the Department of Justice, please include all of the items that you would like to mediate upon, particularly if you want to address systemic issues. Hopefully you reach a satisfactory solution to their differences, and because the mediator is a facilitator, they're not a judge, they're not going to impose their judgment on the parties under the Texas statute. They're prohibited from imposing their judgment under the Keybridge Foundation, the rules of ethics that have arisen. They're also told not to impose their judgment, and it's a confidential process. Now, in Texas, we're lucky that we have the Alternative Dispute Resolution Act, which encourages the quick and expeditious settlement of matters by parties. And so that citation has been listed for you, as well as a handout has been provided that will be available to you tomorrow when this is on.
Connect you to your call. Line muted.
Of the brewery was attempted until the final decision came out that enforced the owner's right to take his dog on at least portions of the trip. It's cheaper. Businesses can avoid the risk of fines and a DOJ enforcement action. The individual can avoid the cost of litigation. Since there are no damages in Title III cases, it may be difficult to find an attorney. Most mediation centers will offer free, low-cost mediation. The Keybridge Foundation program through the Department of Justice offers totally free mediation. It can be done in a 1 to 3 day process usually for even the most complicated of ADA mediation. Both parties are in control of the process. They control not only the terms, but they control the implementation. So this gives you a little more flexibility. It helps to preserve and restore the relationships. And this is particularly important in a rural area where people have to continue to see each other every day, or there may be very limited services. So you want to make sure that you try and preserve the relationship through mediation. It's empowering to both parties. Both parties will get an opportunity to speak on behalf of themselves. They'll be able to control the outcome of the situation. And for many people who feel like their rights have been violated with an exclusion under the ADA or Chapter 121, this is a particularly important and valuable thing for them. It gives people an opportunity to alter perceptions and change attitudes. I think we've both seen, I know Danette and I have both seen it many times during the mediation, this is the first time when a business owner may even actually come into contact with the individual that has been excluded from their facility. They get a chance to meet, to talk with one another, to see the animal in question. And so it dispels a lot of the stereotypes that may have arisen. It gives a chance for systemic change and changes and improvement. Now, I've prepared a list of 8 mediated settlement agreements that will be included on the material posted tomorrow to give you an idea of some of the outcomes that can, successful outcomes that can come from the mediation. Another benefit of a mediation is that it maintains confidentiality. The mediator, neither the mediator nor any of the documents can be subpoenaed. And sensitive medical information, sensitive business documents that are disclosed during a mediation can't be brought into court unless they are able to be brought in by some other means. So that's a nice way of the parties being able to control what is out there about them. And mediation of ADA disputes has an excellent success rate. It's approximately 75 to 85% of all cases settled. So on slide number 47, I've given you an example of several of the types of things that have come out of mediated settlement agreements. These are only samples of things that have come up with retail, medical facilities, and restaurants. Changes in service animal screening and admittance policies and procedures at the facilities to all chains and franchise locations has occurred. You'll see that on slide number 47. For instance, in North Carolina, 1,300 retail stores in 11 states had their policies modified and changed as a result of one claim and one mediation. In Texas, a restaurant which had excluded a service animal made changes to 120 restaurants throughout Texas and California. Florida case that was mediated opened up all of the chains, hospitals in Missouri, Louisiana, and Texas and Florida to service animals. One of the cases was an apology that was issued to a complaining party. Welcome signs added for patrons with their service animals. Donations were made to animal shelters or service dog organizations. In one case, it was particularly tailored that a Mexican restaurant, which had excluded a service animal, the owner in Spanish published an article that he had written about ADA requirements and service animals in a local Spanish newspaper. And then, of course, there are payments to individuals and to the DOJ that might not have occurred in a legal action, but which have been agreed to in mediation. Okay, so if you have decided now that you do want to consider mediation, how do you go about doing that? Well, of course, you can access private mediators or you can go through the DOJ Keybridge Foundation mediators, or you can go through state local dispute resolution centers in order to conduct your mediation. Now, with private mediators, they're going to have varying rates for the mediation, so you'll need to check at in levels of expertise and experience in dealing with disabilities. But I think as long as you check with an organizational, their organizational listings, credentialings with things like the Texas Mediator Credentialing Association or the Association for Physicians, you probably find some private mediators who are trained and experienced in ADA mediation. From my favorite sources for mediation, through the DOJ Keybridge Foundation mediations, which are provided free of charge. What you need to do in order to access that is to file a complaint with the Department of Justice about what your violation is, and be sure to specify that you're seeking mediation. That's how you initiate the request. And Keybridge Foundation has over 400 trained mediators nationwide who follow a strict code of ethics and training requirements. And they have over a 75% success rate, and they maintain their involvement until compliance is completed. Now, of course, one of my favorite sources for mediation is the Alternative Dispute Resolution Center, which in Texas, there are 18 Texas centers that are, some are private nonprofits, some are set up as governmental entities. And they promote peaceable resolution by offering either free or very low-cost mediation, typically through volunteer mediators with very many years of mediation experience. Training and experience with addressing disability issues vary, so it would be an issue that you would want to inquire into. But under the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, there are training recommendations that mediators be trained with at least 40 hours of general mediation training and ongoing continuing education. Now, slide number.
Yes? I'm sorry to interrupt you. We are almost out of time. Do we want to allow for a couple of questions, or do you want to post answers to these questions that have come in later on with the archive? It's up to you.
I'm fine with allowing questions.
Okay, I didn't want to cut your presentation short. I'm sorry. We've got about 2 minutes still. Let's see, we'll start with the first one is, how is false representation of a service animal proved since no proof of certification is required under the ADA?
Okay, there are no cases that have been fully litigated that have actually brought anyone to prosecution for that, of which I'm aware. But the one case that I could find was a civil litigation case in which they were claiming wrongful exclusion and seeking an injunction. And in that case, what the court did is looked at what the evidence was about the animal's behavior in the facilities. It was uncontrolled. It didn't respond to commands. It didn't seem to be doing any tasks. So although we can't say for certainty which factors would be used to prove, I would say that that case probably gives us some guidance as to the factors that would be looked into without asking additional questions.
And okay. Some of the things that are obvious would be if they don't follow, even though they don't have to move desk, if they don't bring the dog in, either to them or on a leash, the dog is really smelly or poorly taken care of, if the dog's not showing that it has its vaccination, things that a service animal would have would be potentially enough. And a few of the cases have looked at it and said, you know, there was enough going on here to significantly raise questions about whether that was really a service animal or not.
Okay, real quick, one more question here. It says ADA does not state one person, one dog. Does Texas statute specify how many service animals the person with a disability may use?
I'm not aware of any specifications regarding animal limits.
I have run into it in a housing context at one point where somebody had several emotional support animals. I've really never had an issue with somebody taking more than one service animal into a public entity or a public accommodation. And I have not seen any cases on it. The statute does not limit it. But I could see that if you were, you know, the restaurant and somebody comes in by themselves with three dogs and they're claiming they're all service dogs, there might, you know, there might be an option to raise a reasonable accommodation. Was it reasonable to allow to expect them to let three in? But you can't always tell by that because sometimes there's a couple that comes in and they both have their own service dog. So there may be multiple dogs, but they may be doing things for different people in the group.
And again, you would have to be able to answer for each of the animals what the specific task is that they're able to perform related to the disability.
Okay, well, I think that is all we have time for. I apologize. I know we ran a little bit long today, and I'm sorry we had to cut the presentation a bit short. I know we lost audio for about maybe a few seconds, and I do apologize about that. We are back online. I want to thank you again, ladies, for joining us today and sharing your expertise. This concludes our program for today. We realize that there are questions for our presenters we did not get to. What we can do is pose them to the ladies and then get the answers and post them along with the archive, if that's okay with you, ladies.
That's fine with me.
That'd be fine.
Again, we apologize. We didn't get to all the questions. Certainly, you can email us if there were other questions that we did not get to. I do have a couple of them in here. We'll certainly post those, like I said, with the archive file. I want to thank you again, ladies, Danette Vaughn and Elaine Roberts, for sharing your time with us, your extensive knowledge with us. We've certainly learned a lot from today's program. And another reminder, today's session was recorded. It will be available for viewing within about 24 hours. At www.ada-audio.org. We also invite you to join us for the next scheduled session for the legal series September 22nd. It's titled Websites and the ADA Accessibility in the Digital Age, and that's featuring Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg of Equip for Equality. Questions, again, regarding this and other sessions in the series can be directed to 877-232-1990 or by email to adaconferences@adagreatlakes.org. Again, you're going to receive a link to the evaluation via email at the conclusion of today's program, as well as instructions regarding securing certificates of attendance, continuing education recognition. That includes the CLEs for those in Texas. We encourage you to participate and share your views with us as they're always valued. Again, Elaine and Danette, thank you so much. And thank you to the folks at Great Lakes for putting in the time and effort to do this with us. Thank you everyone for joining us today. You may now disconnect by closing your browser.